Deuteronomy 5, verse 21. Here is the word of God. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or land, his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. I don't know about you, with 3 weeks still to go, I'm already bored stiff with this general election. Indeed, I'm more than bored, I'm exasperated, even a little sickened by it. Because it's quite clear that in the mind of all the major parties, the only thing the British electorate is really concerned about is increasing their material prosperity, isn't it? The Conservative Party assure us they will reduce taxes so everybody will be better off. The Labour Party tells us it will redistribute the tax burden and up social benefits so that everybody except the top 10% income bracket are better off. The only party which tells us it's going to actually increase taxes for everybody is the Liberal Democrats. And one could perhaps admire this if it weren't for the suspicion that the mere fact they can aspire to the high moral ground in this reckless fashion is in itself a self-admission that they know they have absolutely no chance of winning the election. If they seriously consider for one moment that they could win it, they would be forced, as all the other parties so unashamedly are doing, to make the issue, which all the analysts agree matter most to the majority when they enter the voting booth, the centre of their campaign, namely, improving your standard of living, keeping up with the Joneses. You can't blame the politicians for exploiting people's self-interest in the way they solicit support for their programs. In a democratic system, you only gain power by making yourself popular. And nobody's more popular in a pub than the bloke who's buying the drinks. Nevertheless, I have to confess to you, it has nauseated me this week to be reminded quite so brazenly of how much avarice controls the political destiny, not just of this nation, but of the world in general. I mean, if President Bush doesn't win the next election, it will be because the economy is in recession. That is why. If Russia is thrown into yet another turmoil, then not only will Gorbachev fall, but so will his successors, because the economy won't work. Now, it's fitting that we come this morning to a study of the last of the Ten Commandments. Here is a rule which, if it were believed and obeyed, would overturn every opinion poll in this country and reverse the entire direction of this depressingly money-grubbing election campaign which we are currently being subjugated to. You shall not covet, it says. You shall not covet. That simple imperative carries with it two great implications which lie at the heart of all biblical morality, and together they constitute a massive indictment of our contemporary culture. First of all, this commandment tells us that personal motives are centrally important to God. Not just what we do, but why we do it. Personal motives matter. And secondly, this commandment tells us that personal contentment is a moral duty. That in life circumstances, to be discontent is not just bad for your peace of mind. It is a sin. Nothing should render the Christian then more distinctive in our modern world than our repudiation of covetousness. And at no time is that distinctiveness likely to be more obvious than at a general election. So let's look at these two implications together. I don't promise they will determine the direction of your vote, but they may very well clarify for us the dissatisfaction we feel with the political alternatives that are being offered to us at the moment. If there's any spirituality in our souls at all, if there's any resonance in our minds with the mind of Jesus, it will be displayed by the way we respond to the Tenth Commandment. Maybe the last commandment, but it's by no means the least. You shall not covet. First of all, then, the central importance of personal motives. And that requires us to look at this word covet carefully. See, it's sometimes argued that it was Jesus who took the law of Moses and expanded it in such a way that it included inner motives as well as outward actions. And there is an element of truth in that. It was, of course, Jesus, as we noted in an earlier week, who said that lust was adultery in the heart. But it isn't true to say that Jesus was the first to direct attention to inner motives in that way. Because in this 10th commandment, it's quite clear that the emphasis already falls here on heart attitude. That's the force of this word, covet. This rule is unique in Moses' list of 10, but there's no way this commandment can be translated into a piece of civil legislation. You can't enforce this commandment in the law courts. A prosecution for covetousness? How would you ever prove such a charge unless you were a mind reader? And yet it's surely appropriate that it should be included, because experience shows again and again that this envy, this covetousness, which the Tenth Commandment highlights, is the motivational spring which triggers so many other kinds of criminal and immoral act. Sometimes, as Jesus indicates in that verse I mentioned, it leads to adultery. The lecherous lust for your neighbor's wife that leads to flirtatiousness and to seduction and ultimately to infidelity. Sometimes it leads to Sabbath breaking. The obsessive greed for improved profit margins that leads the workaholic businessman to neglect his family, exploit his labor force, and of course open his supermarket on Sunday. Sometimes it leads to theft. That green-eyed jealousy of our neighbor's affluence that leads to extortion and fraud and dishonesty. Sometimes, as we were seeing last week, it leads to false witness. That humiliated resentment that we feel towards our neighbor's success that leads us to nitpick, to criticize, to slander him. And sometimes covetousness may even lead to murder. Do you recall these words from Matthew's Gospel? Pilate knew that it was out of envy the high priests had handed Jesus over to him. So he asked them, "Who do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus?" "Barabbas," they replied. "Give us Barabbas." "What shall I do then with Jesus?" he asked. They all answered, "Crucify him." Now, there are no depths of malice and criminality to which covetous may not lead us. It's a poisoned well from which foul rivers of moral pollution flow of all sorts. Of course, it's important that we don't overstate the matter. The act of coveting is not necessarily wicked. For the word covet is neutral, morally. It just describes an intense longing for something. And that isn't sinful necessarily in itself. The Bible is not intending by this commandment to forbid all ambition, all aspiration, all desire even. Paul uses the word covet in a laudable context several times. He says, "Covet earnestly spiritual gifts." He uses this same word group in Galatians when he says it's a good thing to be zealous. No, the 10th commandment is forbidding that yearning which fixes its gaze on things we ought not to have or to which we have no title. It's not saying we shouldn't desire some things passionately. Jesus says, "Blessed is the man who hungers and thirsts for righteousness." There is a sort of desire, a sort of coveting, which is right and is spiritual and laudable. But illicit coveting, coveting of the sort the 10th commandment is speaking about, is the prelude to many blatant and obvious violations of God's law. Perhaps it's the Apostle John who puts his finger on the components of this illicit, this sinful kind of covetousness, when he says, "Do not love the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of the eyes, the boasting of what a man has or does. Such things," he says, "come not from the Father, but from the world. And the world and its desires, the world and its lusts, pass away." By the cravings of sinful man there, John refers to the covetousness that springs from our physical appetites, sensuality and gluttony and self-indulgence. By the lust of the eyes, he means that sort of covetousness that derives from our aesthetic taste rather than our physical appetites. But lust isn't the monopoly of the pornography business. It's true some men would sell their souls to possess a woman, but it's also true there are some men who would sell their souls to possess a painting, or even a postage stamp. And by boasting of what he has and does, John alludes to that covetousness which feeds on pride, that bragging of affluence and prestige by exhibitionist display that is so much part of what we call status seeking. This, says John, is the essence of worldliness. The man who ogles the prostitute in the street, I must have her, he says. The man who pines precious jewel or that precious stamp, I must have it, he says. The young couple who yearn for the luxury house on the new estate, we can't do without it, they say. Don't give your heart away like that, says John. Don't put such things at the center of your affections. To do so, as Jesus put it, is to lay up treasure on earth. And people who do that give themselves away. They're not heaven-bound. No matter how religious they may make out they are, no matter how many claims to spirituality they may make, if their inner motives are covetous in that way, if they love the world, then it's quite clear the love of the Father isn't in them. If we want to have hearts and lives, then, that are free from the judgment of God, it's not enough simply to examine our actions. We have to search our motives, our goals, our aspirations. Here's a young fellow who's just about to graduate. What are you going to do with your life, you ask him. Oh, he says, I want a job in the city. I want to win promotion. I want to get to the top. I want a Golf GTI and a Docklands penthouse. That's what I want. Well, there's nothing wrong with ambition. We need wealth creators. We need entrepreneurs. We need financiers and stockbrokers and accountants. Economic progress is a positive and a desirable goal. God put Adam on earth to make it productive and to develop its potential, as well as to care for it and to steward its resources. Jesus himself seemed to endorse this when he told that parable of the fellow who was given a talent by his master and told to make good use of it. But he buried it. When the master came back, he offered it back to his master unimproved. Why didn't you invest it with the bankers? The master demanded. Then I could receive my money back with interest. Cast this unprofitable servant away and give his talent to others who will make better use of it, he said. It is clearly a good thing to want to maximize your potential, to use your gifts, and in that sense to be successful in your career. There's nothing wrong with ambition. There's nothing necessarily sub-Christian or worldly or discreditable about it. But why do you want that city job? Why do you want that Golf GTI? Why do you want that Docklands penthouse? What's your inner motive? That's the question we have to ask ourselves if we're to face the Ten Commandments. And if we're wise, we will not rest until we have answered it with brutal honesty. T.S. Eliot in that great poem, Murder in the Cathedral. The last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. God is not just concerned with our deeds. He's concerned with our reasons. Motives matter. And I have to say, though I can't prove it, for I'm not a mind reader either, I have my suspicions that there is a hidden agenda that informs the ambition of a great many men and women in our yuppie post-Thatcherite culture. And it is the agenda of covetousness. The craving of sinful men, the lust of the eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does. I fear those are the things which are controlling our life goals and aspirations. Of course, it is not necessarily morally superior to pursue a low-paid vocational career in preference to a highly paid commercial career. But sometimes I think it would be a morally safer course of action. Perhaps that's what Jesus was getting at when he said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, Not that he believed there was any virtue in poverty per se. But as Paul told his young friend Timothy, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. People, he says, who want to get rich. People for whom that is their motivational spring, the desire to get rich, that covetous spirit. Such people, he says, inevitably fall into temptation and into a trap, into many harmful, foolish desires that plunge men to ruin and destruction. Why, he comments, some people eager for money like that have even wandered away from the Christian faith and as a result have pierced themselves with many griefs. Inner motives are immensely important. Why are you applying for that job and not the other one? Why are you voting for that party and not the other one? Ask yourself that on the 9th of April. Because they promised to cut my taxes? Because they promised to increase my pension? Because they promised to spend more money on my child's education? My. Can't you see the covetousness in that persistent little first-person singular possessive pronoun? My. My taxes, my pension, my child. Do nothing, says the apostle, out of selfish ambition. In humility, consider others better than yourself. Each of you, he says, should look not only to your own self-interest, but to the interests of others. This, he says, was the heart attitude. This was the motive, the inner spring that characterized Jesus in his journey to the manger and to the cross. And if we would be his disciples, he says, that must be our mind. That must be our heart attitude. That must be our motive too. For motives matter. This 10th commandment tells us so when it says, you shall not covet. But it tells us something else. It tells us also the central importance of contentment. Listen again to the 10th commandment, and this time I want you to notice the areas in which it suggests a sinful covetousness operates. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or land, his manservant or his maidservant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, the background, of course, to these things which Moses specifically prohibits the Israelites to covet is the fact that in the ancient world there were three, I suppose, basic indicators of a person's social standing. There was, first of all, his family. The caliber of his wife and the number of his children, these in the ancient world were a status symbol. There was, secondly, his land. The size of his estate, the number of his servants, these in the ancient world were a status symbol. And thirdly, his wealth, measured in the ancient world usually by the quantity and the quality of his flocks and herds. These in the ancient world were a status symbol. This was how you knew whether a person was important or significant or not. His family, his land, his wealth. And it's significant then that these are the three very areas which the Ten Commandments focuses upon. Why? Surely for this reason. The basic problem with the covetous person is that they see their personal value and significance as solely determined by such socially defined parameters, such status symbols. They have such an inadequate view of their own self-worth. They can only really feel they have made it in life, that they are important enough to be valuable to the world, if they force others to admire them for their status symbols, for their family, their land, their wealth. So for the covetous person, life becomes a competition. for the covetous person, as this commandment clearly indicates. His neighbor is his rival. He looks over the garden fence to see how green his neighbor's grass is in comparison with his own. Is his wife more impressive than mine? He asks himself. Is she more beautiful? Has she borne him more children? Does she run his domestic affairs more competently? I wish she were my wife. Is his estate more impressive than mine? Are there more rooms in his house? Are there more acres in his farm? Are there more servants in his household? I wish his estate were mine. Is his wealth more impressive than mine? Are there more donkeys in his stables? More oxen in his herds? More gold in his bank? I wish his wealth were mine. Why does he come to such a verdict? Why? Because if he see his comparisons prove unfavorable to him, he feels somehow inferior to his neighbor. I'm not worth as much as my neighbor is. His self-esteem is diminished, his pride is wounded, his ego is threatened, you see. It's out of that fundamental, self-inflicted sense of humiliation that his covetousness derives. Life for the covetous person becomes a never-ending struggle to keep up with the Joneses. And isn't that exactly what has happened to almost everybody in our Western culture? Isn't that the root of so many of our miseries? We have turned life into a competition for self-esteem. Under capitalism, it's an individualist competition. Me against the rest. Under socialism, it's a collectivist competition. Them versus us. It doesn't really make any difference. The ironic truth is that both are the economics of envy. One man envying other men, one social class envying another social class. What's the difference? It's rooted in discontent. Everybody is trying to boost their sense of self-worth by means of status symbols. And unfortunately, such a competition is a zero-sum game. I can only boost my own self-esteem by diminishing everybody else's. In such an atmosphere of rivalry, there are always going to be more losers than winners. There are always going to be neighbors within sight who have more than we do. Invariably, then, such an atmosphere of competition generates pandemic discontent. And as we said at the beginning, the 10th commandment assures us that such discontent is not just a tragic folly. It's a sin. God requires us to be contented people. This is not just good for our peace of mind, it's a moral obligation. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, he says. But the truth is, of course, we do. For a happy marriage is a status symbol today, just as it was for the Jews. Oh, life would be so much exciting if I was married to so-and-so. Why can't you be like him? There doesn't have to be any infidelity involved, you see. Just discontent. Just covetousness. And it isn't just the married who are vulnerable to it. Think of the single person. The guy or girl who wants to get married so much, but everywhere they look, what do they see? Couples. Married couples, engaged couples, couples going steady. How do they feel? They feel like failures. They feel rejected. Their self-worth is diminished because they're single and everybody else is married or engaged or going out. It's a status symbol, you see. This is a tragic thing about going out today. Your boyfriend or girlfriend is your status symbol. That's why you carry them around on your arm. And for those without such status symbols, it breeds discontent. Covetousness. No, says God's law, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or land. Oh, but so many of us do, don't we? For a home is a status symbol today, just as it was for the Jews. That's why we try so hard to move up the mortgage ladder, no matter how high the repayments prove. That's why the DIY shops have grown so huge and have to open on Sunday to satisfy the demand. That's why every other house down the road is having a conservatory built or a loft extension or double glazing. And it doesn't matter how nice we make the house. It doesn't matter how adequate it becomes for our needs. There's always somebody down the road who's gone one better, isn't there? And that peeves us. We can't feel secure any longer. We want something bigger and better. So discontent breeds covetousness in our heart. No, says God. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house. You shall not covet his manservant or maidservant, his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor either, it says. Oh, but so many of us do, don't we? For possessions are a status symbol today, just as they were in ancient Israel. Oh, today, not menservants and maidservants, so that would have been so not so long ago in our culture. No, these days it's more likely to be dishwashers and built-in kitchens. Not so much an ox or a donkey, today it's more likely to be a Ferrari or a Porsche. If only I had this, we say to ourselves, if only I had that, I'd feel I'd really made it then. I'd be satisfied. But of course we never are. Because even when we've obtained our object of desire, there's always some other if only to tantalize and torment us further down the road, isn't there? A consumerist society is dedicated to the cultivation of an insatiable desire for more possessions. There's no end to the chain. I came across a story some years ago of an Australian home in which there was a canary in a cage. And a snake got into this house and wiggled its way through the cage bars and ate the canary. The trouble was, once the canary was inside its stomach, the snake found it couldn't get out through the bars again. So it was trapped. And when the owner of the home came back, he chopped off its head with the garden shears. That's what you call being a prisoner of appetite. And there are so many of us today similarly enslaved by our absorption with acquisitiveness. They'll do anything to push up their standard of living another notch. Gamble till they're ruined. Borrow money till they're bankrupted by debt. Work overtime till they're hospitalized with ulcers and blood pressure. Worry. Worry till their nervous systems crack. And what's at the root of all this insanity? It's covetousness, isn't it? The covetousness which is not satisfied with what it's got. Because our neighbour has more. What's the answer to it? Contentment is the answer. Find a route of personal security which does not need to be bolstered by status symbols. Contentment. There's a passage I want you to look at with me in relation to that. You'll find it in Philippians chapter 4 in the New Testament. Philippians chapter 4 and verses 12 and 13. This is a remarkable passage because it is the Apostle Paul's personal testimony to the way in which he had overcome covetousness in his life. Let's listen to what he puts, how he puts it. I know what it is, he says, to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. That word that Paul uses there for contentment is rather interesting. It has a background in Greek philosophy. The Stoic philosophers used this word a great deal. They observed that people are discontented fundamentally because they want things they haven't got, just as we've observed this morning. People make the mistake, said the Stoics, of chasing these unobtainable goals in the illusion that once they've got them, they'll be satisfied. They won't be discontented anymore. But of course, the desire for things, once it's gripped the human heart, is never satisfied in that way. The appetite for novelty and accumulation's endless. So say the Stoics, the world is full of discontented people because they want things. Well, said the Stoics, the solution is quite simple. Give up wanting things. purge your mind of desire. Desire, they said, is the problem. You mustn't want anything at all. You must save everything you have. If I lose it, I don't care. You must save everything you could have. I'm not interested in it. You must become completely indifferent to your circumstances. You must not feel anything, desire anything, love anything, hate anything. That way, they said, you'll be content. If there's nothing you want, you won't be upset if you haven't got it. Someone has said that the Stoic remedy for discontent is a bit like cutting off your head to cure a headache. If you haven't got a head, it can't ache. If you haven't got any feelings, they can't be hurt. If you haven't got any desires, they can't be frustrated. Now, I mention this because the Stoics use this very word that Paul uses for contentment. Literally, it means self-sufficient. That was the ideal Stoic individual, a self-sufficient person, somebody who was completely self-contained, who didn't need anything in their environment, in the outside world, to make them happy. They were completely self-sufficient, content. It was a quality of life the Stoics greatly prized. But what I want you to notice is that though Paul uses the Stoics' word for contentment, the content with which he invests that word is radically different from the Stoics, in at least two major ways. First of all, I want you to notice that his contentment was far more balanced than theirs was. Look again at verse 12. I know what it is to be in need, he says. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And Paul is highlighting for us here the two opposite dangers for us as regards lifestyle, if you like. On the one hand, there's the danger of self-indulgence that yields to gluttony and greed. But on the other side, there's the danger of asceticism, which leads to miserliness and a killjoy, kind of sour spirit. Paul's showing us in these verses that the Christian lifestyle, Christian contentment, is not in one or other of those extremes, but in a careful balance between the two of them. The trouble with the self-indulgent person in Paul's vocabulary is that he hasn't learned to be hungry. And the trouble with the ascetic is that he hasn't learned to feast. But Paul says, I've learned to do both. That's what I mean by contentment. The Stoic was a bit of an ascetic, you see. He knew how to do without things. But his philosophy cast a sour perspective over all the things he did have. He didn't know how to abound. He didn't know how to enjoy plenty. Paul could. Paul could rejoice in abundance when God provides it. A Christian for him was not to be a miser, demonstrating to the world the vanity of material things by the frugality of his table or by the poverty of his home. There's no virtue in being miserable for the sake of it, says Paul. Jesus, of course, constantly likened the kingdom of God to a great party thrown by a wealthy king. No, there'll be no bliss in heaven for people who can't enjoy a May ball, you know. Those abstemious spoil sports who fear compromise with worldliness at every turn. No, no. There is a balance here. Not wanting to be rich, but not despising prosperity either. Paul knew how to be abased. That meant the rejection of self-indulgence. It didn't worry Paul that he had to do without things. But he knew how to abound also. And that meant the rejection of killjoy miserliness. He could enjoy a good meal without a guilt complex about the starving millions. He could enjoy a soft bed without fearing he was pampering the flesh. Christian contentment's not like the Stoic, to be able to endure all circumstances through gritted teeth. Still less is it like the ascetic, to contrive adverse circumstances in the belief that you're morally superior for doing so. No, Christian contentment is to be able to rejoice in all circumstances, to adopt a positive attitude to plenty or need. And the Christian can do that, says Paul, for one reason and one reason only. Because not only is there a distinctive balance about his contentment, there is also a distinctive source to his contentment. See verse 13. I can do everything, by which Paul means, of course, not that I am personally omnipotent, but in this context, I can cope with all circumstances in the way I'm just describing. I can do everything, he says, through him, that is, through Christ, who gives me strength. The Stoics' placidity was the result of personal discipline. It was the result of iron self-control. And for that reason, though it was a highly respected philosophy in the ancient world, it wasn't dreadfully popular. The majority of people couldn't face the frigid lifestyle of the Stoics. But Paul is testifying here to a contentment that was available to anybody and everybody. It wasn't natural to Paul's personality. He'd had to learn it. But neither was it self-manufactured. He hadn't drummed it up within himself by some kind of discipline. It wasn't the psychic secret that he had discovered through yoga meditation or something like that. No. This power to cope with all circumstances, this contentment, derived from outside his own human resources, he says. He discovered it through him, through Christ, who gives me strength. Now, let's be clear about this. This verse 13 of Philippians 4 is not intended to be advice which you or I in our prosperity offer to a street beggar. James tells us there is a kind of super spiritual Christian who tells the hungry man, Jesus satisfies without relieving his need. And he says that's hypocrisy. Now what we have here is not advice for the prosperous to offer as cold comfort to the poor. What we have here is the testimony of a poor man, a man indeed who was, when he was writing this, in jail. And it's the testimony of that poor, jailed man to those who are, humanly speaking, much more prosperous and comfortable than he was. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. See, as he sat in that prison cell, no doubt damp, no doubt hungry, certainly lonely, Paul tells us he did not have to grit his teeth to bear it. He had something which flooded his personality with such a glorious sense of well-being, such an inner empowering, that whether he was rich or poor, he was content. Jesus had done that for him. I can do all things through him, through Christ, who strengthens me. Now let me ask you. Do you call yourself a Christian this morning? Well, I want to ask you. If you do, is Jesus enough for you? Is he enough? You see, we Christians don't need to create a sense of self-worth for ourselves out of the status symbols which our secular culture espouses. We know we are valuable. We know we are significant. We don't need such pathetic accolades to boost our ego. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has died on the cross. He has shed his blood for me. If that doesn't make me worth something, what does? So no matter what the world thinks of us, no matter how despised we may seem in terms of the status symbols the world counts precious, we know our inner nature is noble and dignified and destined for eternal glory. Can you be content with that? Is Jesus enough? It's a big question, isn't it? Content with our family circumstance? Yes, perhaps Mrs. X has got a new baby and you'd love to have one too. But for some reason it doesn't seem to be working out. Well, yes, perhaps Mr. Y's wife is a pretty young thing. Well, yes, perhaps your best friend has just got engaged. But is Jesus enough? Jesus enough to make you content? Content with your home? Well, yes, a bigger kitchen would be nice. And it is tedious being overlooked by those flats. And it will be so much warmer with double glazing. But is Jesus enough? Enough to make you content? Content with your possessions? Well, yet a new car probably would break down less than the old one. And the three-piece suite is getting decidedly tatty around the edges. And a dishwasher would save a great deal of elbow grease when we have all the kids round to eat. But is Jesus enough? Ultimately, you see, this issue of covetousness hinges on whether our life consists in the abundance of our possessions. Whether, like the rest of the world, we measure our self-worth by the status symbols of our secular culture. Or whether, like Paul, we have discovered in Jesus such a root of fundamental human fulfillment and satisfaction and significance in ourselves that we can be content whatever the circumstances, well-fed or hungry, in plenty or in want. You shall not covet, says the 10th commandment. You shall not covet. Here is a commandment that if we obey it, will not only keep us out of the mental hospital, perhaps, or even the prison. Here is a commandment which, if we take its values on board, may take us all the way to heaven. For at the root of this commandment is spirituality. The spirituality which does not look to this world for the center of human meaning, but which looks to God. Let's pray together.